from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station. You get out and you create a crowd. And you push back on them. And you tell them they're not welcome anymore, anywhere.
She sounds like such a nice lady. Fun fact about Maxine Waters, who we were just hearing here at the top of the Reason podcast, Monday Editor's Roundtable edition, and welcome to it. When she first entered the Congress, the number one album in the country was To the Extreme by Vanilla Ice. Hello, everybody. I am Matt Welch. I am joined from Washington, D.C. by all three of my colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangy Ward, and Peter Suderman. Shut up! Shut up! Yeah.
It's a real pleasure to have my name mispronounced, man. Are you having a stroke?
These names with the vowels at the end, it's hard for me to wrap my brain around. For those of you who are logging into your social media accounts for the first time since Friday, you might discover that we're apparently having some kind of civil war in this country based on restaurant etiquette and who it's right to ask to kick out. As you know, Friday, Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked very politely, from what I understand, by the restaurateur of the farm to table place, the Red Hen in, I think, Lexington, Virginia, get the hell out of her restaurant on account of being a bad person from the point of view of the restaurant and its employees. And ever since then, everyone's talking about whether we are entering a new age of horror in our political and civil discourse. So let's get right at that. Before we do, just a reminder, subscribe to us on iTunes. It comes on your phone a little faster that way. Suderman, you strike me as the queasy one of this group about such behavior. So my question to you is, what is wrong, if anything, at long last, Peter Suderman, with a little targeted public shaming of powerful public officials?
Also, I worked at a restaurant.
Oh,
what kind of restaurant?
I have a seafood restaurant.
Florida?
It was in Florida. There were alligators there. I have so many stories. I do not have any stories about refusing service to public officials. However, I was made aware later, much later in my life, that it was a restaurant that Rand Paul frequented on his family vacation.
Really? Explains everything.
It does. It explains nothing. And that is what I'm actually going to attempt to do here. Yeah, I'm kind of queasy about this. Let me first offer a limited libertarian defense of asking Sarah Huckabee Sanders to leave your restaurant, which is that a business owner has or should have the right to refuse service or give service to anyone for any reason or no reason. This was apparently done as you sort of described it, as a get the hell out. This was the owner came in after being alerted by the staff, asked Sarah Huckabee Sanders to step outside and said, I'm sorry, you're going to have to, I am going to say you have to leave.
Your kind are not welcome.
Yeah, basically it was the droid scene in Star Wars, Mos Eisley from Star Wars, and then took care of the tab, right? So it wasn't, an aggressive kind of, it was a confrontation, but it wasn't, get the hell out, we're angry, right? It was just like, this is not going to continue. We are cutting off this interaction. And so
Did the actual
I have no idea what they
anything,
eat, started, and I don't think it's
it,
relevant.
They started
and I think,
suckling pig that was being separated by,
that's right,
from
they did,
from the
that's
mother
right,
pig
they did
or something?
Eat, they did eat a cheese plate, or were working on one.
I hope it was American cheese, or was it foreign cheese?
I think this is a pretty important discussion to have, and it's really helping us understand. In fact, this is my whole sort of argument, is that this is a moronic discussion. And this is the problem, is not even so much her being asked to leave, but the fact that we cannot discuss. We're going to talk about it for 10 or 15 minutes today. As far as I can tell, no other story was talked about on cable news for the last 72 hours or so. There are major write-ups and opinion pieces, some of which may even have been written by people who I am quite friendly or close to. We may be running something along these lines at Reason.com, but this is the dumbest possible timeline. And if we want the national conversation about politics to be about this, then we are all going to lose. And we are all going to, like, this makes no one's life any better. I do, like I said, I do have some reservations sort of about the kind of the implications of this, which is that it's not just Sanders who gets kicked out or asked to leave. It's that if this becomes sort of becomes allowable, becomes tolerable, and you see folks like Maxine Waters, you see folks all over Twitter, you know, blue check marks with tens of thousands of followers saying this is great. This is the way to win against Donald Trump. This is the way to defeat the Republicans. I do think that there are some pretty pernicious follow-on effects that come from something like this, potentially. But on its own, as a form of, but look, on its own, I think that this is basically sort of non-issue, the kind of thing that happens in a society where people are allowed to have people have free the freedom of association. As a trend and as something that Democrats are saying, this is what we're going to do to sort of further the hashtag resistance, I think it's moronic and really corrosive to society.
So it doesn't matter, like, and it's super corrosive. Go ahead, Nick.
I like it being I think it should be based not simply on political affiliation, but also on different types of diets. So we need a vegan resistance. We need a ketogenic resistance, maybe a gluten-free resistance. You know, this is very serious stuff.
Are we resisting gluten or are we resisting
people
who are gluten-free?
We're resisting it all, damn it. Like, you know what? Because it's too important to start getting lost in the weeds. We just resist. Yeah, let the fucking restaurant owner, if you don't have to bake gay cakes for Nazis anymore, you don't have to serve Sarah Huckabee Sanders. But what kind of fucking country are we becoming where this is what we're talking about? Both what we're doing and then the media is talking about this all the time. I don't know. Like, did any real news happen over the weekend? Are we still $21 trillion in debt? You know, do we still, or have we fully run through the memes that people put on the back of Melania's jacket? You know, there's something, I think we're just missing something.
Well, I mean,
important.
Isn't the reason why people are talking about this, Catherine, is that we are imagining or foreshadowing our future, which is that everything becomes more politicized. The political aspect of our debate, which is thankfully still a minority of overall oxygen spent in the universe, but it seems like it's growing, is increasingly like pitched battle, scorched earth, lots of two-word phrases with ch sounds in it. And so you can imagine that this is what things are going to look like from now on. And it seems to be kind of a dark timeline.
You know,
it's a dank timeline.
Yes.
So the question of whether it's the stupidest timeline or the darkest timeline, I think, is sort of relevant here. I think
why can't it be both?
It can be both, but I actually don't think it's either. I am now going to say something that makes our timeline even darker, which is that I saw Hamilton this weekend at the Kennedy Center. I know. And like, those guys thought they were living in the darkest timeline. Like, I know we make this point all the time, but even in a all singing, all dancing musical version of the relationship that the founding fathers had to each other, like, oh my God, it was horrible. It was so partisan. They were so cruel to each other. They casually ruined each other's lives over personal infractions all the time. That was their main activity for like an entire period in the late 1790s early 1800s.
Did Button Gwinnett get kicked out of McSorley's or something for being Democratic Republican?
The idea again that this is somehow a uniquely awful moment, I am skeptical of.
But it doesn't have to be uniquely awful
to be an awful. Yeah,
I mean,
and
it's like
it is awful, yeah, right? Like, yeah. This is the thing where, like, you know, Jonathan Haidt's work on partisanship, one thing that he's not great at solutions. Like, I love that dude, but like, his solutions are kind of like, maybe if everyone just like hung around DC and had dinner together more often across the aisle, that would help. And this is the opposite of that, obviously. So I don't know if his solutions are good, but it's the only straw worth grasping at. And we are, sorry to be Matt Welsh here, we have now lit that straw on fire.
Can we ask though, is it something that the Trump administration has done? I mean, like, to take a step back from it, assuming any of this is legitimate, you know, meaningful, but Is it because the Trump administration is actually doing stuff that is worse?
Well, it's not that. So I mean, there's two parts to this. One is that the Trump administration has a unique ability, I think, to drive the left, the sort of liberal base, totally nuts. And that's in part because of the Trump administration's actual policies, and in particular, the family separation stuff that we've been talking about for the last month or so. But it's also because Donald Trump prefers this mode of engagement himself. And if you look at, you know, basically what Trump did with all of the NFL kneeling stuff, that was just a kind of pure culture war partisanship play. No actual kind of policy at stake, nothing meaningful, just like, are you with me or are you against me? Let's choose sides. Let's make the draw these lines and make the sides as, you know, as stark as possible. And so in many ways, I think that I don't want to say that Donald Trump is responsible for getting Sarah Huckabee Sanders kicked out of that restaurant, but he has leaned into that style of engagement. He seems to prefer it. In fact, there was, I think I've said this on this podcast before, there was a report at the beginning of this year, I believe it was in Axios, where somebody close to the president said, look, the president doesn't have an agenda for 2018 in the traditional sense. There's not like a bunch of policies that he's trying to pursue. Instead, he is going to look for culture war flashpoints to seize on, much like what he had already done with the NFL issue. And he's going to try and play those up to energize his base. And in fact, there was a New York Times front page story over the weekend showing that Republican support for Trump is up, and that in that part of the reason the Republican support for Trump is up is that they believe that liberal critics of Trump have gone nuts, have gone way too far, and are just overreacting to absolutely everything.
There are a couple of details of this, though, I think, that are worth pointing out. One is this mostly became a thing when Sanders tweeted it, right? So she is, you know, they were asked to leave the restaurant. It probably would have been reported on because everything is reported on. But this becomes a big deal when Sanders tweets it, which, you know, she works for Trump, right? Like, he wanted this to be a thing. She wanted this to be a thing, and now it's a thing. So it was in, you know, in some ways it was the administration's choice to blow this up into a big issue. The other detail, though, I think, is that the waiters who wanted to throw Sanders out, they wanted to do it because of the administration's position on trans people in the armed forces. That it was, you know, this was in some ways a sort of this was not about the overall administration's gestalt. There's this very strong thread of belief that the Trump administration is particularly poisonous for gay Americans or for trans Americans. And it's sort of tied to Mike Pence, who's a real bugaboo. And that, I think, is interesting because he's not particularly bad for gay Americans. Like, he's not good news. He's not going to, like, advance the causes that by and large gay Americans want advanced for their own well-being. But tweaking the rules about who can serve in the armed forces based on the exact details of their gender transitions is hardly a massive rollback of gay civil rights.
It also came kind of in the wake of Kirstjen Nielsen, I believe I'm pronouncing that right, the Secretary of Homeland Security, being booed out of a Mexican restaurant in Washington, D.C., few days before. So there was sort of a trend aspect.
There is a trend aspect to it. There's a bandwagon aspect to it. It's Pride Month, so people are particularly excited about conflating or sort of glomming together. Like, I saw plenty of people at Pride parades this weekend on my Instagram that had fuck ICE, you know, banners and tattoos and all kinds of things. So there's, you know, it's a coherent political worldview, which Trump is on the other side of. But, you know, I don't think we should read every active hashtag resistance as full-fledged. Hey, people care about specific issues.
Can I ask, do we all agree, and we might not, but, like, you know, we do need a reset of some sort from this type of activity. It's just, it's tedious, it's draining, it's boring, it's stupid, it diverts us from not talking all about other politics, but about, at least on occasion, from talking about serious policies that the government should be dealing with. How do we go about getting to that reset? Like, is it going to be a economic collapse? Is it going to be an outer space alien invasion? Is it going to be a bunch of people saying, fuck it, like, I'm just not going to talk about this sort of shit, and I'm going to start my own conversation. I mean, like, if we
as Greason recently reported under the byline of Ron Bailey, we are probably alone in the universe, so okay, I guess we shouldn't bank on that one. Alien invasion.
Okay, so
I think we
have
to wait till the Trump administration is over. I can't imagine an intra-Trump reset.
And I think that this sort of discussion, this and liberals basically, you know, Maxine Waters is saying, let's do more of this. Let's make this our what we're campaigning on. Let's make this our kind of, if not the core, then a significant part of the way we are going to respond to the Trump administration. I think, I don't want to say that they're going to get Donald Trump elected, but just by this one restaurant owner refusing service to Sanders. On the other hand, it's not helping them. It's not going to make.
Okay, so what can we do? What can we do? What can we do to have?
When that's what they need to do is basically flip counties that Obama won and Trump won. Yeah. They need to flip them back to the Democrats, and those counties are not going to respond to these sorts of stories by saying, "Yeah, you know, I think this is what I want out of national politics and national life. I think I'm going to vote against Donald Trump this time."
I would just point out that there is a one historical mini parallel that might be worth exploring. A kind of
if it involves the California Angels,
I can
work, be really upset.
I can work that in.
I'm going to be upset.
But no, the former governor of the great state of California, a guy who has more than a little bit in common with Donald Trump, Arnold Schwarzenegger, he was the target of incredibly targeted public shaming for about 18 months soon after he arrived in Sacramento from the California Nurses Association, which is a real kind of in-your-face union out there. And they would go to every public event that he went to. He would go to his, you know, kids' middle school graduation, and there would be
his acknowledged kids or his illegitimate kids.
We live in the 21st century, Nick. We're not judgmental here. Okay. And they would just boo and heckle him. He couldn't go anywhere. He couldn't go to a California Angels baseball game anywhere without having 10, 15, 30 really angry aggro nurses booing him. And as someone who
were they dressed like nurses?
That's a good question. I don't think so, because I would have remembered the visuals.
If they were dressed like with the little caps on and stuff, that'd be pretty
good.
So
there's I think Jim Henley on Twitter, and God help me for quoting Jim Henley on Twitter on a recent podcast, but said something like, this is the analog of targeted sanctions, you know, the type of sanctions that are, or smart sanctions against, you know, individual Russian oligarchs. Those sanctions work a lot better, actually, than general sanctions, which just kind of impoverish the population. So imagine a world in which there was discipline on that side of the aisle, and it was attempt to change the behavior and create a public sanction against a certain type of a politician, then you could imagine that there being positive practical effects. Now, you can also, I think, a lot more easily imagine stupid mob violence at a gasoline station.
those gasoline easily. Stations, they're
Before we leave the topic, I want Nick to respond to kind of one concept here. I saw Ken Pope Hat White tweet, I think, this morning. I'm open to the argument that confronting politicians in public is corrosive and could go badly in the long run if it becomes common. Feel that butt coming? But I will not listen while anyone who supported or condoned this demagogic shitbird lectures me about our civic culture. Sit your ass down. Does he have a point, Nick?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is part of the problem, and I guess Peter and Catherine, in a way, were also talking about it. Trump has destroyed civility. And again, he didn't do it overnight or anything. And he brings out the very worst in his detractors, which then ends up, you know, kind of exploding on them. Anybody who is going to get on a high horse and be like, how dare you do this to a member of the Trump administration? You know, we're living in a society. It's like, you're talking about a guy who couldn't literally, I mean, 30 seconds into saying I'm running for president, started talking about Mexicans as rapists. Like, it's over. And that's why I think we need a reset because this isn't helping. And it's poisonous. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I think we were talking about Jack Dorsey of Twitter having to like apologize for eating at Chick-fil-A. And it's like, what the hell? You know, it's like, can we have, you know, the fucking World Cup's going on. You know, the weather is really getting shitty in DC. I mean, there are so many more important things we could be talking about.
And Mexico's doing, go ahead, Kathy.
I just, you know, I would never presume to disagree with Popat because he is right about everything. However, I am really skeptical of this, what essentially boils down to a they started it argument. Like the whole thing about civility is that you offer it to people who are as yet uncivilized. Mm. And, you know, this is what a lot of people on the left are saying about Trump right now, is like, he doesn't deserve X. And it's like, fair treatment or like a, you know, time to air his views or a cheese plate or whatever it is. You know, I think there is at least a legitimate case to be made for like, yeah, he's a douchebag. You be better. And, yeah. And you
be
know,
best.
Be best. You be best. And I think, you know, this is what etiquette is about. It's not about whether people deserve your politeness from you. It's about what kind of person you are. And, you know, I don't mean to be all old school on it. And God knows.
We got to get Miss Manners.
Whatever.
I always bring yeah. Miss Manners in here. Like, yeah. Miss Manners versus Popat is my dream debate.
Oh, my God.
And
yeah.
I will.
She would kick his
hand
ass.
Hand the full budget yeah. of Reason Magazine over yeah. to funding that activity.
I'm looking forward to that issue.
Yeah. It's just going to be a very special issue in which Miss Manners and Ken White discuss things. I am sympathetic to people, and I am of course in the end supportive of the you can serve whoever you want in your business, but it's not the badness
I,
of Trump
I
doesn't give us any
owner,
information
yeah.
about what respect or politeness we
I also think the restaurant owner is wrong here. For the same reason they should serve gay people. I mean, like, you know,
right.
Nobody's
so just
saying,
because it is you can nobody, do something
yeah,
doesn't mean that you should. And there's a sort of liberal argument going around right now that's like, well, you know, if you sided with the cake baker who didn't want to make the cake, then obviously you have to side with this restaurant owner. In one, it was a legal argument, and I side with the cake baker as a legal matter. They should not be required to serve in the same way that as a legal matter, this restaurant owner should not be required to serve. But both of them should just get over themselves and make the cake and serve the damn cheese plate.
It'd be one thing if, you know, and I haven't heard this reported, so I only have two sources. I need a third. But, you know, that Sanders wasn't wearing shoes.
Well,
so,
no shirt, no shoes, no service.
That's right.
There we are.
You know,
so. Let's transition to actual policy that touches people's lives and is related to the beginning, which is, of course, the family separation at the border issue here that has heightened the emotions and certainly mangled the lives of thousands of people here. We've talked about this pretty much nonstop for the last four or five episodes here. So let's get into a summational type of view of it now that the policy has been semi-suspended. It's complicated. The Flores agreement's going to have to be legally challenged. So, but what did we learn about ourselves, our country, this administration, Peter Suderman, in the family separation crisis? What is the take-home moral of the story at the end of the South Park episode here?
I think the take-home moral is that libertarians are right about immigration policy. In that it turns out to be not only difficult but counterproductive to take the hardest line on immigration enforcement, explicitly the Stephen Miller line, which is that we have to have a zero tolerance policy. We have to do the things that are harshest, not only because we think they will be effective, but because we think we will be basically putting on a good show for the public, and they will then come along with us. We will heighten some of the contradictions, own the libs, and make America great again by being awful to people who are trying to come over the border and live better lives. And also, to be clear, make our lives here as Americans who are already citizens better. I think that the big lesson here is that this sort of approach to immigration doesn't work, and that the hard right, restrictionist right, immigration policy is one that not even somebody like Trump, who doesn't back down for anything, can sustain for even a month.
Catherine, what's your takeaway from this period?
My takeaway is a corollary to that, which is it turns out the only way to dramatically sway public sentiment in favor of immigration, in favor of the position that Reason has advocated for many, many years, is to just like turn it into the most tabloidy, hyper personalized story possible, right? Like, my takeaway as an editor is there are children crying everywhere because they are separated from their parents by bad immigration policy. There are always children crying somewhere because their parents are away from them, because our borders are not as open as they should be, because we don't have as much legal immigration as we clearly have the capacity to absorb. We publish stories about this all the time, but, you know, the power of pictures of crying children to motivate people to give a single fuck about this issue is huge. And obviously a big part of what's going on here is not empathy for our fellow human beings. It's hatred of Donald Trump and a desire to score points on his administration, sometimes even in contravention to the specific facts. As it turns out, that poster child was not quite exactly on point for what people were upset about. But
the Time magazine cover that featured Donald Trump juxtaposed with
a crying child who turned out not to have been separated from its mother, and also, I don't know, was it a boy or a girl? I couldn't tell.
Girl.
Okay.
Monster.
Her mother. But
just
my takeaway is more
crying
children.
Gender is a social construct.
Yeah. More crime. Well,
because it's an important issue, and truly, children and parents are being torn apart by immigration policy all the time. And this just happens to be a more photogenic and politically point scoring moment for that thing. But that thing is bad always and everywhere.
All of the, I think the three main images associated with this turned out to be either false or doctored or, you know, from whole different civilizations, which is kind of fascinating because
did the jacket turn out to be fake?
I think so.
No.
Well, no, not that. But, although I did see a good one that had
the tariff thing on the back. Yeah, I wanted to retweet it, but Mark Perry from AEI tweeted it, and he clearly stole it from someone and didn't credit the original artist.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, it was the Melania jacket with the Scott Lincecum tariffs are counterproductive and failed to achieve their own policy.
So I think, you know, Matt, one of the maybe the instructive things, and like I'm kind of on this hobby horse of wanting to, how do we get to reset? You know, how do we get to a point where we're like, okay, you know, just let's take a breather and then start a new conversation. It was good to see Trump's, as Peter and Catherine were saying, like basically what Trump did was he pushed, he literally, you know, enforced a law or a policy that the Republicans have always said is essential to the success of the Republic, blah, blah, blah. You look at it and it is, you know, it's not that big a deal in terms of the numbers, but it is hideous and deeply offensive and wrong. And it acts, you know, it shows something is so screwed up with our immigration policy writ large, something has to change. So in a way, it demystifies that. And it rubs hardliners' nose into what they say they want, and see if it's not even politically viable, even if they can stand it. But then on the other side, I think some of the responses, including all of the fakeness of the images and everything, that shows again, you know, that Trump is having an effect on people, and it's not a good effect in terms of he is bringing out their worst elements. And so to the extent that we can say this type of incident gets us closer to finally where people are, you know, I mean, it's like an old couple, or, you know, it's like Sid and Nancy or something, like, you know, we need an intervention where we get off the junk for a while and then maybe we don't stab each other on, you know, in the Chelsea Hotel.
Wow.
America is like Sid and Nancy. I would just add to this.
Except that they loved each other more, obviously.
Yes.
We love each other.
Well, we're
America,
all on the same side.
Not
we're not
us,
part of the
America.
Problem.
Yeah. Americans love each other.
Well, that was Sid and Nancy, too. What they really loved was themselves.
They do. The numbers that are striking to me and suggest that we're going to be with this thing for a while are the couple of polls that came out. The first one was from Quinnipiac, and then afterwards from, I think, CBS News. I'm sure there's been plenty since, that basically, the family separation policy, as polled, is unpopular with Americans by like 40 percentage points, 66 to 27, I think was the Quinnipiac one. But popular with Republicans by 20 percentage points, 55 to 35 in the case. That's kind of amazing, because if it's 55-35 Republicans, and I didn't see this broken out, and a negative 40 overall, that means, you know, it's going to be what, negative 50, negative 60 among non-Republicans. That is a fundamental difference of opinion. And I think the president, having successfully differentiated himself in the campaign on this issue more than anything else, and having, as Peter mentioned before, looked at 2018 as a culture war year, we are going to be with this issue for a long time in this awful kind of nakedly ugly way in which he's using words like infest, is holding, Mike Huckabee is sending out tweets accusing Nancy Pelosi of wanting to have MS-13 to be her cabinet and all this kind of stuff. That's going to happen. And it's going to happen because of the other takeaway from this, which is that even in the face of all of this, including a widespread public revulsion at it, Congress still can't do a damn thing. Still couldn't just pass its own thing saying, don't do this anymore. It's complete. It's well, within the reason, your power to do that. And they couldn't even do it.
The reason why is though, because of those polls. It's because the Republican base is so heavily on Trump's side on this, even though the country is on the other side, that in a Republican controlled Congress, there is no way to move this to passage. And so Republicans are hostage in many ways to their own base. Even I suspect that if you said, look, you have a job for life, you're going to be reelected forever, or you'll never be reelected again, doesn't matter, one of the two, right? If you sort of took away the kind of get reelected incentives from every Republican in Congress, I suspect that there'd be a lot more support for reining in President Trump. But the clear fact is that the Republican base doesn't want them to. They're becoming – the Republican base, while skeptical of Trump up front, certainly during the campaign, he was sort of he was the most popular candidate in the primary, it turned out, but he was not a kind of a candidate who had just sort of had obvious majority support from the beginning. The Republican base is becoming more pro-Trump, and in part because of stuff like what we were talking about with Sarah Huckabee Sanders. And that seems to be the trend here. While I think that story, like I said, is just kind of deeply moronic, the fact that it ends up dominating the airwaves and the conversation, it seems pretty clear, based on the reporting, based on some of the polling, that that kind of thing is driving people who are already prone to being kind of pro-Republican, who have some sympathy for Trump. It's not like flipping votes, but it's making people more energized in favor of Donald Trump and in favor of a Trumpified Republican Party.
Matt, I have a question for you. Yeah. Do you think that those poll numbers reflect basically people's opinions about immigrants or people's opinions about the rule of law? Because my Twitter feed, which is admittedly the farthest thing you could possibly get from a scientific sample of the American public, the rule of law point people are obsessed with, like this idea of like people who come across our border illegally broke the law, and to follow the law is essentially a moral good. Like that thing.
And that's why
more
my favorite
than
politician is Joe Arpaio.
Yes.
That's the thing. The amount of the people who are most in public office, who are most vociferous about this, routinely break the fucking law. Joe Arpaio, Chris Kobach just got his ass handed to him in Kansas, the vote fraud fabulist Secretary of State and likely next governor of the state of Kansas, was sued because he was making people show proof of citizenship before they could vote in the name of combating all these illegal aliens voting, of which he could produce almost none. Just absolutely rebuked time and time again by the judge sitting, George W. Bush appointed judge there. And he's a hero. And Joe Arpaio's a hero. And David Clark, the sheriff of Milwaukee, who probably has never even talked about immigration, he's a hero, too. All these people break the law all the time. So, yes, I agree that there is a real thing. It's like get in line. And the rule of law is important. But it usually takes about one scratch before you see that that maybe isn't always the primary driver in these cases. I've said and written several times that addressing those objections are very real. And some of the people who have them the most are naturalized citizens here, and not just in a, you know, lifting the ladder up once you've climbed it point of view, but they got in line. And so some of those people tend to be like, hey, you should follow the rules, and we shouldn't be rewarding people who break those rules. It's a legitimate concern.
But it's also, you know, part of the rule of law is that, like, if you come here and you claim asylum, there's rules that you get, you know, that are supposed to apply to you. And those are, now we're saying, oh, now we're just going to fucking arrest them and deport them immediately without any kind of trial.
Right, which
yeah,
President
Trump's tweeting that he's not going to, that he wants to not have any sort of due process at all, which people are supposed to be guaranteed, whether or not they are legal. That is following the law.
This is, I find the rule of law stuff, that's just a dodge always, Catherine. I don't have any problem with letting everyone in. It's just the rule of law.
Well, so, yeah, right, you can tell that, but you can tell the people who have serious rule of law concerns from the people who are just anti-immigrant by people who say, look, I think we should follow the law now and we should change the law. It's very simple to tell. And if you think,
so that's
and
like the, Dinesh D'Souza.
And the restrictionist rights, it makes rule of law a big issue and then says, well, we should change the law to reduce the number of immigrants, period, coming into the country.
Let's transition into happier news. The Supreme Court on Friday issued a ruling in favor of the third party or the Fourth Amendment vis-a-vis the third party doctrine. So if you are if you have material, in this case, cell phone location data that's held by a third party, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4. And then the numbers are a bit tricky because of Neil Gorsuch's weird dissent. Intriguing dissent. But they said the government no longer has the ability to just rummage through your location data. Nick, we've been writing about and talking about this for a long time, including I think I did an interview with Alex Kaczynski about 10 years ago where he pointed to this in the future being like the most important thing because we hadn't figured out where the Fourth Amendment lies in the 21st right. century. Can you kind of take the big picture view on what an important ruling this is going forward?
I think, you know, just simply put, anything that accords more legal protection to citizens and information from the government is a good thing, and it's long overdue. That, you know, the idea that simply because certain records were being held by third parties online or in electronic form that they did not receive the same type of protection that is if, you know, if it was in a filing cabinet in your house. Equalizing that, I think, tends to be a really good thing. And I think it's the way forward. I suspect, you know, and I was thinking about this partly because Catherine and I a while ago taped a podcast about our 50th anniversary, and she was interviewing me about my tenure as editor, and we talked about the issue where we personalized the cover of like 45,000 issues, and it had a bunch of information that was individualized for each reader based on publicly available databases. And there is an upside to that, and not just in law enforcement, having a lot of stuff that is open and available to the public. So, you know, there may be some losses there, but overall, I think anything that makes, you know, the police state, and I say this, I'm not even, you know, I'm not that paranoid about this kind of stuff, but for every time that the law wants to extract information from people, I think it is always a good thing when they have to go through some sort of review or get some sort of internal check that, you know, before they can just do whatever they want.
Catherine, we all know that one of the best verbs in modern Washington is to butt Gorsuch. But my God, what a weird butt Gorsuch here. I know you're not Damon Root or Jacob Sullivan, both whom have written about this.
Aren't I, though?
I don't know. I don't know anymore. I don't even know you. But Gorsuch, what kind of freaky,
yeah,
wonderful
so this
thing
is like
there.
This is like the double butt Gorsuch or something. Like I don't know what exactly happened here.
So this is like a Kardashian level.
It's a Kardashian level of
butt
Gorsuching.
Okay.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Like two scoops of butt Gorsuch.
Oof.
Wow.
Scoops. Okay.
Suddenly,
so,
I'm not going to be eating for the rest of the week.
The idea that you know there was this there is always this problem where, you know, in June in particular, the Supreme Court starts issuing its decisions and everybody reports on them as fast as possible and nearly always gets things wrong because, you know, legal opinions are often subtle and complicated. And in this case, there was a first round when this decision came out where people said, oh, my God, Gorsuch was on the wrong side. Like, take that, you butt Gorsuchers. Take that, you people who were supporting Trump, because they thought at least it would be worth it for the judges. But on closer inspection, as Damon Root points out, it looks like Gorsuch's dissent is actually this case didn't go far enough to protect people's persons, houses, papers, effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. So, you know, he says, I cannot fault the majority for its implicit but unmistakable conclusion that the rationale of Smith and Miller is wrong. Indeed, I agree. At the same time, and then he sort of goes on to say, basically, there are ways that the court could have more comprehensively scrapped the confusing and ultimately wrong guidance from those decisions. So I guess, but Gorsuch is still standing strong.
Isn't it funny, though, the way that all of this stuff shifts so quickly and then becomes like new lines? Because, like, I think we've talked about this in the past, when email was first, you know, when telephone calls came, there was obviously no expectation of privacy, you know, early Supreme Court rulings. And then it's like, no, you have every right to, you know, an email was talked about within, even before there was like legal discussions of it. It was, you know, people in the computer and like the hacker community were like, of course, email, you have no expectation to privacy or even ownership over email because it's always being hosted somewhere, somehow. And it's just now, you know, just it you know, the way that these things change, I find somewhat fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, not as fascinating as those people. I really hope people are still following, nurses are still following Schwarzenegger around and bothering him every time. He's like, oh, you're going to eat that cheeseburger, you fat fuck? You know, you're not in office anymore. Why don't you give that to your illegitimate kids?
Yeah. I mean, you know? I think that it is, though. I mean, you're right that our perception of privacy changes so quickly with the technology itself, including, you know, when I was in college and we had email, you logged in on a terminal that was just like a computer sitting in the middle of the cafeteria,
right,
to check,
yeah,
your email, right? Like, even that, you know, is it analogous to a phone booth? Is it analogous,
right,
to a party line? Is it analogous to a private phone when your employer provides the email? What does,
yeah,
that mean? Like, I, you know, of course, I would always like to say, like, everyone gets all the privacy everywhere, the end. And,
right,
like, warrants should be, you know, obtained for even looking in the direction of a civilian, you,
yeah,
know. But actually, it's true that these things do evolve. I mean, this is, I think, as always, a case to move as much as possible,
yeah,
of human interaction outside of the law. And
yeah, I mean, I'm happy that there's
some limitations to this. I mean, yeah, it is a somewhat narrow decision. There's a couple of exceptions in particular. It's a possibility that records requests without a warrant could still be approved for time durations of less than 7 days, as well as for certain types of emergencies, say a bomb threat, child kidnapping, that sort of thing.
And everything is always an emergency.
Right, so the definition of emergency could be shifted.
We've got to get this gay cake baked now.
In addition, I think you also, you know, sort of the check that has been put on these searches is you have to get a warrant, which means you have to show probable cause. But it's pretty easy for someone who knows how to work the system to find a judge who just sort of rubber stamps these things. And the burden of proof to show probable cause has sort of been expanded and weakened, right? It's a pretty easy test to pass. And so while there is now a kind of a formal check that didn't exist, and I think that's a good thing, and so this is, you know, a victory for civil liberties, it is a pretty narrow and limited decision in certain ways, and I don't know that it is going to radically change the way police do business. It's just going to add an extra kind of a paperwork step.
This is also, you know, part of it is worth thinking about in the larger context of, you know, what we have found out in the past 15 years or so is that the government and law enforcement at every level is surveilling us a lot more than we thought, that they have access to things. And so even if this doesn't change the law very much or in a very significant way, I do think it's good that we're going through a phase where law enforcement realizes that they have to re-legitimize themselves in certain ways. Because, and this goes in cycles, you know, where they feel like they can get away with stuff. And then now, because of Ferguson, and before that, because of Edward Snowden and all of this, it's good. You know, it's good to be reminded that, you know, the government needs to play by rules that will stand up in the light of day. And so, again, even if this doesn't really change anything, maybe it will change the ways in which they operate.
You think there's a Trumpian double down effect, too, though, where, you know, for every cop or every court that says, like, well, Ferguson has really made me rethink, or this requirement for a warrant has really made me question the priority of getting all this data, there are going to be
the Dirty Harry.
You don't even have to be Dirty Harry. You can just be the people who say, like, I'm doing important work to protect our nation, and these people who want to make it harder for me are the enemy, and I'm the good guy. I mean, that's...
Yeah. But I think it's a shift in consensus, and that you know, and this is why people like Popat, you know, Ken White, who was a prosecutor, you know, I think you can build a culture, and that he even wrote for us about that, that, you know, part of this stuff is the law. Part of it is oversight. Part of it is forced transparency. But a lot of it is the culture. And I'm always impressed by people when I've talked to people in law enforcement and whatnot, where they really don't do certain things because they could get away with it, but it is not the right thing to do. So to the extent that we move like inch towards that,
just to keep bringing it back, because that's what we're doing today in America, to the Red Hen thing. Like, that's what was stopping restaurant owners from throwing people whose politics they don't like out before. It was just like, well, we just don't do that.
Right.
Like, it's just an understanding of things we do and don't do. And sometimes those understandings are bad, right? Like, sometimes it's like, well, we don't let blacks in here.
Right.
You know, we don't let all these Asians come to our Harvards. Like, you know, there's the unspoken or semi-spoken understandings about what it is and it isn't appropriate behavior are not always good. Yeah.
Before we get into what we're all reading and watching and performing, since we have Peter Suderman on the line and he understands things the rest of us do not, last week saw, I believe, the introduction of association health plans, which is a concept that was championed by Rand Paul, among other things, sort of an end around Obamacare. And I've already probably mangled everything that what it means. But Suderman's on the line. So give us 90 seconds. What the hell is this? What does it mean? And did freedom win a little bit?
No, that's actually right. It's basically an end run around Obamacare. It's a way to kind of work outside of the system. Rand Paul's been arguing in favor of this for a while now, basically saying, look, what we need to do is allow small employers to band together and effectively act as large employers. And so if you've ever seen large employer health insurance, right, they have a lot of options just because they have a bulk purchasing power. What this does is it allows small businesses to basically sort of work together to create the same sort of bulk purchasing power. And in particular, they're going to be able to buy insurance that does not that is not covered by all of the same regulations that Obamacare, by all the mandates that Obamacare puts
on insurance.
So, like,
the minimum plan will have less in it.
So they will still have guaranteed issue pre-existing conditions rules, but they will not have all the rest of kind of the plan minimums and some of the other things. And they'll also have more freedom to price these plans. And so what it is, it's a workaround for Obamacare. It's part of sort of two things that the Trump administration has done, the association health plans being one, and then the other one as being an expansion of options for short-term limited duration plans, which are basically going to end up being kind of effectively long-term duration plans, which are also unregulated health insurance that you can buy less expensively, at least if you are a relatively healthy individual on the individual market. And so the, you know, sort of the Obamacare supporters would say that this undermines Obamacare. And in some sense, that's a little bit true because it is likely to take some healthy people out of the risk pool and therefore exacerbate the existing instability and pricing problems within Obamacare. On the other hand, Obamacare doesn't allow people any way out to begin with, and kind of any system that allows you to work outside of the scheme that Obamacare has created is inherently going to undermine Obamacare. And so this is something that I think, you know, sort of in a non-Obamacare world, as Cato's Michael Cannon has pointed out, this might not be a great idea because it basically accepts the federalization of healthcare regulation, and it also assumes employer-sponsored insurance sort of as the primary mechanism for people getting insurance. On the other hand, now that we're in an Obamacare world, what it does is it makes some of Obamacare's prices and regulations, costs on individuals and businesses somewhat more transparent, allows people an alternative that isn't Obamacare, and so is going to give people, going to give at least some people some more options.
How many people are on Obamacare these days? Like, what percentage of the insured market get stuff through the Obamacare?
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe that this year signups were somewhere in the range of a little over 9 million. It could be a little less than 9 million.
And that's out of like a healthcare market of hundreds of millions?
It's much less. So the individual market prior to Obamacare was about 5% in most states, except in the few states that had passed pre-existing conditions rules, where it's typically 0.5 to 1% of the market, because basically the pre-existing conditions rules without a mandate, Massachusetts obviously an exception here, but the pre-existing conditions rules without a mandate in nearly every case caused the individual insurance market to totally melt down.
So in other words, we go back to that question of like, we spent all of that time talking about that while we could have been talking about kicking people out of restaurants for 5% of the healthcare market.
And so I wrote a piece for the New York Times a few months ago arguing that Republicans had kind of stumbled into a replacement plan without repeal. And this is part of it, is that what you're seeing right now is that Republicans, without actually repealing Obamacare, are working around it and within its generalized scheme to make it more Republican friendly. And they're going to do that in ways that are quite frustrating to Obamacare supporters, but are designed basically to create cheaper alternatives to the plans that are available under Obamacare, and to kind of create not to kind of tear down Obamacare directly, but to undermine it just a little bit by creating escape valves. And that's really what the association health plans do.
Very good.
I won't be happy until they force nuns to pay for birth control.
I don't think that the association health plans will have a cheese.
Speaking of Westworld, okay. We now transition into our what cultural products are you consuming? Catherine, start us off.
Well, as I mentioned, I went to Hamilton. Did you? I mentioned that
you
I went
did,
to Hamilton.
You did.
I went to Hamilton.
Did you like it?
Yeah. I did
was
like
it.
Can
was
you sing
it
a little
great?
Bit?
It was great. I cannot sing a little bit from it. I was hoping actually for the DC specific performance that they would like maybe tweak it a little bit, or like acknowledge that this show being put on in DC right now is sort of funny. The crowd does do a big applause, and I imagine this is routine for the, like, there's a line where they say immigrants, they get the job done, and everyone's like, ah, fuck Trump.
Did Mike Pence get shamed at this one?
There was no Pence shaming, but there is.
It's like the Rocky Horror Picture Show, so
yeah.
There's like an audience
interaction. But I wanted it to be more Rocky Horror Picture Show. So like, there's a whole song that's like, the lyrics are, it must be nice to have Washington on your side. Like, there's opportunities there for some, you know. But given that I'm just talking about embarrassing cultural consumption, I'm going to go all in this week and say that I also watched Netflix's new romantic comedies. They're like trying to like figure out how to make romantic comedies super formulaic, cheaply and good. And word was that they succeeded once. It's called Set It Up. And it is, I am not kidding you, there are two assistants. They work for two big wigs who work in the same building. They try to set up their bosses. And the two bosses are a fancy high-powered magazine editor and a VC. And my husband works in venture capital. This movie is so far from our real lives that it's genuinely upsetting. Like, first of all, I do not have a tiny assistant to just like abuse and like shout at her to fetch me truffle mac and cheese. And I'm really upset about that. And neither does Dan. Second, it's not at all clear that Hollywood knows what venture capital is, but it sounded kind of like maybe cool. So they were just like, he's a VC. But like, there's a bunch of monitors up with like Japan's stock market. And it's like, yeah, that's not right.
You know, the one true, perfectly true representation of what it's like to edit a political magazine, and Matt, you'll back me up on this, was the Girl with Dragon Tattoo books. I mean, it's all eating sandwiches, fucking, and neo-Nazis.
A like lot of Mac products, too. There's a lot of careful descriptions of Mac products. Yep.
And the offices are kind of grody.
I will say, I know that our listeners are not necessarily in the market for a good light romantic comedy, but if you are, Set It Up's pretty good. It's also set in in New York and actually looks like New York, which is a refreshing change from movies that are set in New York and look like kind of Toronto and kind of Indianapolis. Yeah. So,
because they often are Toronto.
Yeah.
Nick.
So those are my recommendations, and screw you all haters.
The only other really good portrayal of business is in any Woody Allen movie. It's like, what are you doing? I'm doing business. We are having business meeting with to make the business.
I also want to say that the younger male lead, he ultimately demonstrates that he is worthy of the love of the young lady by abandoning business, because business is bad. Yeah. So just so we're clear.
Nick, what are you gobbling up?
A couple things, but I'll just focus on Seymour Hirsch's memoir. We're supposed to interview Cy Hirsch, the award-winning scandalous reporter who uncovered Millet during the Vietnam War, as well as like Abu Ghraib and a series of other, you know, major earth-shattering exposés. And it's his entire life story, and it's pretty interesting. Some of the reporting stories are great, like just how he got stuff. But I know if and when we talk to him, I'm going to grill him because he somehow is claiming to be like lower class. But his father owned a dry cleaning store, and he ends up going to the University of Chicago in the 50s. So he's like all his sources, he's full of shit.
Wow. We're going to hold you to that. Suderman, no spoilers. Go.
Well, I did watch the finale of Westworld season two.
No,
I don't want to spoil that.
Spoilers.
But I'm not even going to talk about it at all, because I also watched Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom and The Incredibles 2 this last week. The Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, I really did not love the first Jurassic World, which I guess is the fourth Jurassic Park movie. This one is not exactly a great movie, but it's really pretty effective on a kind of sequence level. The set pieces just kind of work, even though the movie is completely ridiculous and has just a kind of bizarre idea about sort of a dino military industrial capitalism.
That's the name of this podcast.
Yes, yeah. Right?
From and like, now on.
It is kind of fascinating, though, to watch these movies, which are giant hits, all of them, even the ones that have done less well are merely mega hits rather than kind of massive global events. And to see that all of them, in some sense, are criticisms of like mass capitalism and pop culture, right? And like the first Jurassic Park, there's that scene with John Hammond who's about, you know, we slapped it on the lunchbox, or I guess it's Ian Malcolm who says that, but like, you know, he's talking about his little ant farm or whatever it is, and about selling these things. And it's all about sort of like the despair in your heart that comes from selling the dinosaur experience. And so here in the new one, it all sort of comes back to this capitalist type who is sort of working as a front for a foundation that is actually interested in saving these dinosaurs. But what he wants to do is take their genetic code and turn them into basically turn them into weapons, you know, sort of like a tech dinosaurs that can be then sold to evil corporations and or governments. It's not entirely clear. So the action is pretty great.
Like
the story is kind of,
I mean,
nuts.
Like, so instead of delivery drones, it's like pterodactyls.
So there aren't many flying dinosaurs in this one. They only appear very briefly before we get to the sales.
How about,
portion.
Is there a whole debate over the transitional life forms? Can they use the regular bathrooms, or do they have to go to their own separate bathroom?
They don't address this issue, but I do feel like
dinosaur scientists
who are mucking with dino DNA are going to have to figure that out.
Yeah,
given
Archaeopteryx,
that
you're just going to have to hold it in until you go home.
Yeah, I think this actually should have been a scene in the first Jurassic Park. I'm frankly surprised, given how prescient it was, that it wasn't. Then I also saw The Incredibles 2, and it's pretty great. It's not quite as good as the original, but I think I could probably mount an argument. I'm not quite sure if I want to right now, that it is the best superhero movie of the year, maybe even of the last couple of years.
But wait, is Aquaman coming out this year?
I haven't seen Aquaman. Yeah. I mean, it's not out for another 6 months. Even the trailer hasn't debuted online yet.
I would just like to point out
fucking
so
Aquaman. You know, here we could have been talking about Aquaman and how shitty Aquaman is. you know, for the whole show. Instead, we talk.
Anthony Lane's New Yorker review of The Incredibles 2 includes an extended sequence about getting a boner in a movie theater because he's so lusty after
the
wife.
Because Elastigirl has so much junk in the trunk. Yeah, I know. It was one of the craziest things I've read in The New Yorker.
It's super upsettingly awesome.
It's really weird. It's like he just let his id like write the column and nobody
This is a weird thing that we don't see as much in movie criticism anymore, but movie criticism used to be, with the exception of Pauline Kael and a few others, through even the early aughts, almost exclusively the province of dudes. And there was just, for as long as I've been reading movie criticism, which is about as long as I've been able to read, just a huge amount of like, of thirst. That's exactly right. Of like, guys would, movie critics would talk about the movie and they'd be like, oh, the mise-en-scene and like, here's a history of the director. And that actress is hot. Usually you didn't see it though in cartoons.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie. Like, Elastigirl is goals, but it's like still probably shouldn't be the main focus of
a children's movie review. My culture that I've been consuming and really enjoying with my 9-year-old, soon to be 10, is I believe it's Netflix series, A Series of Unfortunate Events, the Lemony Snicket business. Mm-hmm. It's executive produced and Count Olaf starring Neil Patrick Harris. And it's just very colorful and funny and arch. And from what I understand, I didn't see the actual movie version, but I understand that was kind of a stinker. But it's really good.
The movie was good. I was disappointed that. But that series is great. And it has like Weeds, the old show Weeds. It has great individualized opening sequences.
Yes,
for the different episodes.
Which is pretty great. So
does she like reading the books, or is she up there yet? Because, those books kind of came out at the same time as Harry Potter. And one of the things that's fascinating about them, and I saw this in my older son, the writing is very, like the narration is very meta. And it's like it was like a master class in teaching kids about irony, where something can mean two or three things at once. Very literary and fun and interesting. Yeah. And I highly recommend the series.
Which used to be the thing that children's, like Sesame Street's very meta.
Yeah.
And there was, I think this is actually Malcolm Gladwell's fault, there was a New Yorker piece at some point like 10 years ago that was like, don't do irony and meta for children. They don't like it. They don't get it. Do Blue's Clues. Do the same basic, the surface is the depth, like pedagogical thing, and like that's what kids actually like and respond to.
I realize that Blue's Clues is like the kids' version of SVU.
It's a lobotomy, what it is. It's horrifying.
If you're into super meta children's programming, I really recommend googling the YouTube the outtake from the Muppets in which Fozzie the Bear and Kermit talk. It's like it was never part of the show, but it's just sort of a kind of semi-improvised conversation in which they talk like have an existential crisis about being puppets. And they're like kind of just sitting in a tree and talking about what it means to be a stuffed bear rather than a real bear, and like it's heartbreaking and beautiful and sad, and like I feel like it actually kind of expresses my sort of questions about the meaning of life better than maybe any other piece of art I've ever seen.
Again, I want to say, like, the meta Muppet outtake about existential truths, like, we could just plug that in at any point in the Reason podcast and no one would even notice that we had stepped out. Like, this is what we're up to.
I feel like a real bear now.
I think it's pretty clear that Matt Welsh is Fozzie Bear. Everybody think about that. Thank you. The end.
Please, in addition to subscribing to us on iTunes, write a review about Peter Suderman's existential stuffed bear crises. Because I think the world deserves to know more than just that. And then just stay tuned throughout the rest of the week. We'll have a couple other podcasts per week interviewing various delightful and newsworthy human beings. And with that, have a happy Monday, a good week. Don't give up hope. Be careful out there. Courage. And
bug Schwarzenegger.
And serve the damn
whenever
cheese
whenever you
plate.
See him.
Heckle Schwarzenegger. All serve right. The cheese. Goodbye.
I believe in you. I don't understand it at all.
I know. I do understand that I'm not a real bear. But I am. I know what I am. I am what I am.
Well, that's true. We all are what we are.
But I'm a real puppet. I'm happy with my lot in life. I am just pleased that I'm not here amongst nature and wilderness. I'm just pleased that I can be a bear representing my species in this beautiful tree.
What's your excuse, Frog?
I was watching the camera going up in the air there and coming back down again. That was a wonderful...